Sorry.
Hello, this is Barbara Peters from the Poison Pen, and I'm sitting talking to Lauren Willig. And as a disclaimer, before we start this conversation, I'm going to say that we have just polished off an entire bottle of rosé.
So and it was delicious.
It was delicious, but we're going to need to allow for that. So I want to talk to Lauren about our June history book of the month, a brilliant novel called The Summer Country, which is a little bit different than other things that she has written. I don't want to say what got, where'd you get this idea, because that's like the most boring question ever, but what was your inspiration for writing this book? Because I know you've had it on the boil for what, like 10 years?
That's right. Now, you've heard me complain about this book before and how I couldn't get it out of my head and desperately needed to write it. And everyone told me a book it said in the Caribbean wouldn't sell. So I feel very lucky to have finally had the chance to write this novel. I can't quite believe it's actually out there, because this book has been with me at this point longer than my husband has. Which is kind of mind-boggling, considering my husband and I have two children together. But 10 years ago this June, I went on a plantation tour with my two best friends from grad school, and we heard a story about how the plantation had burned down and a child had died in the fire, the Portuguese ward of the owner. Only the child was neither Portuguese nor his ward. She was his daughter by an enslaved woman.
So can I interrupt for a moment and say that the reason that he called her Portuguese was because the color of her skin was going to be dark and not British white.
Exactly. And, so when I was writing the Pink Carnation series, what feels like ages ago now, I actually, the final book in the Pink series is set in Portugal. I did a bunch of research on what English people thought of the Portuguese in this time period. And it's really quite fascinating, because the Portuguese were European, but yet not entirely from English eyes. So it was a perfect compromise for a slave owner on Barbados to say that the child was Portuguese, because the Portuguese were still respectably enough European but considered swarthy. So this made a great excuse. And also it's the Napoleonic Wars. So, on the peninsula, the Duke of Wellington is fighting the French. Englishmen are falling in love with Portuguese women they meet along the way. So it makes a perfect excuse to say, well, this is a child of a friend who was fighting in the peninsula, who fell in love with a Portuguese woman, and this is his child. So I am raising this child out of the goodness of my heart. But what really struck me about the story was not the child herself or the slave owner's motives in this, but was the fact that no one knew anything about the mother. And I kept wondering where the mother was in this story, whether she had agreed to this deception, whether they had somehow snuck her into the household as a nursemaid, but how heartbreaking that would be to be there with your own child, but your child not to know you for their mother, or whether the child had been taken from her against her will. And I also wondered, so in the real story of the Portuguese War, there were two kids. So, which means that this was a relationship, if you can call it that, of some duration. So, why, if the man cared enough to bring the kids into his household, why didn't he free them?
Well, another possibility, which you haven't mentioned, is that maybe she died.
That's true.
Childbearing was a high-risk activity, and it's certainly possible that he cared about her or whatever, and then she died, so you don't really know whether...
You really don't know. It's, I started digging into the archives, and I found a bunch of these stories where the mothers didn't die, but where, for whatever reason, that the slave owners could not free their own mistresses or children, where, bizarrely enough, and this is not something I think that gets mentioned a lot of slave labor was organized on a lease situation, where slave owners would lease labor from other slave owners. And so there's the case of one of the people I was researching was a man named Joshua Steele, who came over from England to Barbados in the 18th century, and he fell in love with his enslaved housekeeper. I mean, we know he loved her. We don't know how she felt about him. But she belonged to another man. He was leasing her. And for whatever reason, the other man never agreed to sell her. So Joshua Steele couldn't manumit her, and they had two kids together. And they lived together as man and wife until Steele died. They raised the kids in their household. And when Steele died, he tried to leave his fortune to his kids. And he might have gone away with it. Actually, his executor forged manumission papers. And he almost got away with it, except that Steele's sister back in England brought a lawsuit. And the English courts were like, God, we don't want to touch this one with a 10-foot pole. And they bounced it back to Barbados. And the courts in Barbados ruled that property couldn't own property, and the kids were disinherited.
Well, it's true that they actually treated the enslaved as property, not as people. So,
yes.
You know, I mean, there's some interesting parallels to Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemming, but, you know.
And I will admit, that was a little bit on my mind as I was writing this book, because there were a series of articles that came out a few years ago about the relationship between Jefferson and Hemings and the question of, can there ever be true affection in that sort of power imbalance? And that was something I thought about a great deal while I was writing The Summer Country. And the only way I was able to make it work for me for this book was that Jenny, my enslaved heroine, does not belong to Charles, the man who's in love with her. And on top of that, because even if she hasn't belonged to him, he's still in a position of power above her simply by being white and a man. But on top of that, she's a much stronger character than he is.
She's a fascinating character. So you've chosen to bookend this story. Your protagonist, your narrator, arrives in 1854. Mm-hmm. But the heart of the story and where it really all starts is back in 1816
yes.
when Napoleonic Wars were just over, right?
Yes.
And there was an actual slave rebellion in
yes.
Barbados, which did not succeed, but nonetheless was
pretty
horrendous.
Impressive while it lasted.
Yes.
I mean, and it's one of those things where there hadn't been a serious rising of enslaved people on Barbados since 1698. That had been the last one. And the Barbados slave owners had been pursuing a policy they called amelioration, which meant that they gave their slaves slightly larger rations, allowed family networks to remain largely intact and so forth, let their enslaved people have passes to visit other enslaved people on other plantations and have parties. And they thought of themselves as very lenient slaveholders, despite the fact that the code on the books was one of the most draconian in the West Indies. In practice, they felt themselves very lenient, and they really believed that their enslaved population loved them. And so when the rising happened, it took the plantation owners entirely by surprise. And it spread very quickly, and then the militia came out, and it was the rebellion was brutally repressed. But what we do have, and what made incredible fodder for a historical fiction writer, was the interviews that were held after the rebellion with many of the instigators. So we have from their own mouths what happened, how it happened, why they did what they did, when they did. And admittedly, all this has to be taken with a grain of salt because it was under interrogation. But it's still fascinating because we so seldom have the voices of enslaved people.
That's very true. So this was the Sugar Island, and mm-hmm. to make that work, you did have to have people working the sugar cane, which is
yes.
a pretty brutal thing. And it was part of that triangular trade of rum, sugar, mm-hmm. and slaves, which the British had going.
Yes.
So they were not willing to give up their slaves anymore. You know, Britain actually emancipated slavery in what, 1838? Wasn't
that it? Well, what
happened
was the edict, well, actually, at home it's earlier. So what happened is an imperial edict came down in 1834 saying, hey, British Sugar Islands, you are going to emancipate your slaves, but not immediately. So they instituted something called a period of apprenticeship. And the idea was that this would get the formerly enslaved people used to being wage earners and wean the former plantation owners off having free labor, and everyone hated it. Because, well, the formerly enslaved people were like, well, if we're free, we're free. And the plantation owners were like, if they're free, why are we still, you know, paying to house and feed them? And so full emancipation wound up coming in 1838, earlier than they had planned.
So in 1854, there's another catastrophic event in the island,
mm-hmm.
and what is that?
And that was a cholera epidemic, because I call this the MMK principle, that every good saga needs a cholera epidemic. And so what this is actually, so in 1854, the population of Barbados was, if I recall correctly, about 126,000 people. And over 20,000 people died in the space of a month in a massive cholera epidemic. And so my book is bookended on the one side by this cholera epidemic and on the other by slave rising. So lots of nice, cheerful, upbeat topics.
So your heroine arrives in Barbados because she has a puzzling inheritance.
Yes, she has. So Emily Dawson, a vicar's daughter from Bristol, she's the poor cousin of a wealthy merchant clan. Her grandfather grew up poor in Barbados. He was one of the Red Legs, one of the poor whites who live in the parish of St. Andrews. And she knew her grandfather grew up poor in Barbados and made good, but no one knew he owned a sugar plantation. And so he dies, and suddenly the sugar plantation that no one knew he owned is left to Emily, the poor cousin. And so she goes to Barbados with her cousin and her wife to find out what happened, why her grandfather left her this unexpected inheritance. And she gets there and she finds it's a burnt out shell that was burned to the ground during the rising of 1816. And so we go back and forth between Emily's experiences in 1854, trying to figure out why her grandfather left her this plantation and what's going on, and the 18 teens, when an idealistic young plantation owner comes home from Barbados, from England to Barbados, and falls in love with an enslaved woman from the plantation next door.
You've always liked framing stories with two time frames, haven't you? One ahead of another, and then kind of moving back and forth. I'm trying to remember, there's an actual time jump is what that's called.
Right.
You know, as opposed to time travel or whatever it is.
The terminology is so confusing.
Well, but I mean, it does make sense, you know, to call it time jump. And, you know, for the reader, it's interesting. There's a certain amount of foreshadowing, you know, in the present. And then there's puzzling because we don't really know what happened in the past. So your suspense curve is built up of very different things.
Right. It's why I think of it as a puzzle box book.
Right.
Because the reader has to figure out how the pieces fit together. And to be honest, I mean, this book was my homage to MMK and John Jakes and Colleen McCullough's Thornbirds. And so I really thought about trying to write it linearly, to start with Jenny, my enslaved woman, and work all the way up two generations later to Emily. And I found I just couldn't, it wouldn't write itself that way. That I am so used to writing the puzzle box kind of story that I just had to revert to.
No, that's your natural storytelling mode. And the problem also is that you wind up having to do things like prologues, which are pretty artificial, you know, if you're going to write that kind of story. But, this book succeeds on a lot of levels, one of which is, you know, you really immerse us in this landscape and culture. There is a mystery element to it, although it's really not a crime novel. It's really historical fiction. But it's really the characters that I think make it come alive, and you know, what happens is as you watch these characters, you really get immersed in their lives, and you care about what happens to them. And,
thank you. Well, I've always been fascinated by ordinary, relatable people who get caught in circumstances beyond their control, where they make one decision and then another and then another, and then they find themselves caught in these impossible situations where you look back and you think, how did I get here? How are we in this mess we're in? But you understand every step along the way.
Well, I think that's true, but I also think, you know, that they are overtaken by events that they could not have foreseen or they cannot control.
That's true, and I think part of writing this book was, what really struck me when I went on that plantation tour all those years ago, was the inhumanity of a system where parents couldn't be together or be with their own children, where these subterfuges were necessary for a father to be with his children, and where a mother is left out of the story entirely. And so this book is very much about that, about what happens to normal sentiments and normal family relationships when a twisted system like slavery enters into the equation. For among other things, and you know, this is not something I've wound up discussing much, but Jenny, my enslaved woman, is the body servant of her own first cousin, a plantation owner named Marianne Beckles. And their relationship is an equally twisted thing, where on the one hand they're related, they're cousins, on the other hand they're mistress and slave, and it absolutely warps what would in other circumstances have been a close familial relationship.
All of that is true, you know, yet this is a 19th century book, and yet it's amazingly resonant in the 21st century.
Yes.
So I think reading it is not only, you know, going into the past, but making us question about things that are going on in the present. We haven't really mm-hmm. resolved these issues.
No, I agree. And it's funny, as I was writing this, it felt, unfortunately, more and more relevant that we need to be reminded of the basic humanity of all people.
I think so, too. Well, I'm delighted to have read it and to have talked to you about it, and I'll look forward to whatever you're writing next.